Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the Acura TL with Bluetooth phone connectivity. Learn more at Acura.com.
It's only natural today to look ahead to the coming year, but we're going to look a little bit further, to the next 5, 20, maybe even 50 years. And for help, we brought in Sid Mead. He calls himself a visual futurist. His job, to predict the look and the feel of tomorrow. He's designed everything from future cars to office spaces for corporate clients. But Sid Mead is perhaps best known for his work in the movies. He designed the elaborate science fiction worlds in films such as Blade Runner, Aliens, and Tron. And he says there's a very real science at the center of his crystal ball.
I've been designing for corporations for, well, ever since I graduated from Art Center here in Los Angeles in 1959. And I learned a methodology, which is industrial design, and it's a way of analyzing what the problem actually is, and then you design to solve it. And that applies across the board, whether it's a movie or a TV show or electronic games, which is lately what I've been involved in, and the real world.
Can I ask you to join me in looking ahead into the future, since we're at the start of a new year? If you could take out that proverbial crystal ball for us and tell us how you think, what you think we might see in the years ahead. And let's begin by talking about transportation. How might that change in the future, both in terms of mass transit and the cars that we drive to and from work or the shopping center?
The future of travel involves getting there either physically or by electronic means of duplication. And as we perfect the whole art of holography, you will find that a lot of human contact face-to-face will be accomplished by telemedia, duplicating the person, much like portrayed in Star Wars, when Princess Leia appears on this little tiny holographic figure, and it's reality reduced and then recreated at destination. And it's very valid.
We're going to move on in a minute, but first, put a timeline on that. We would expect to see this kind of technology in 10 years, 20 years?
Within 15, I think quite easily. The danger in predicting is that you predict too conservatively. That's been proven throughout technical history.
Let's talk about the home.
The home, I worked on a project for 20th Century Fox. All the bells and whistles of what we think the future home will look like, wall-sized TV. Take the Jetsons and just give it a very nice high-fashion gloss, and you have that vision. The trouble is, how do you treat a wall-size screen? Do you put something in front of it? Do you have grandma's dining room projected on it when you're not receiving programs? Do you have a jungle? Do you have animals? Do you have a zoo? How do you treat that wall when you're not watching it? And all that's going to be a fashion and a lifestyle consideration when that capacity becomes available, and it's becoming available very quickly.
Mr. Mead, walk us through the home of the future. What will it look like? What will we see that we don't see now?
What we'll see will be an elaboration of what we already have. Bill Gates, his house up in Redmond, he is buying the rights to some of the world's best-known paintings. So you will rent the picture on your wide screen or your wall screen. You'll rent Pinky or the Blue Boy or a Degas or a Rubens, and you'll rent that picture on your wall or on your screen for a certain length of time, just like cable TV. So the home will recognize who you are. It will follow you from room to room. If there's one person, two persons in the room, the lights go on. When you leave, the lights go off. And it will be a whole environment that is like living with an entity. And if you think that's scary, think how scary just normal street traffic would be to a horse and buggy population back in the early 1900s. And the other factor is the house will become a place where you are even when you're not there. The house will talk to people, take orders, refurnish the refrigerator, run the household like a major domo without actually having an employee that does that.
Run the refrigerator? We're getting low on milk.
Exactly. You'll have jackets, clothing that the patterns change, shift, the cars coated with coatings that can be electronically adjusted. They're working on that now, either polarization or actual molecular shift in light refraction capabilities.
So you can change the color of your car on command?
On command. Mercedes is working on that. All the car companies are working on a polarized or electrically manipulated coating on the car.
What is the now wow product of the future that will change our lives, the cell phone of the future, the thing that will absolutely revolutionize the way we live?
I really think that implants will be the next stage. It sounds scary, and it probably is, but implants will allow you to have a device which is a biomechanical kind of thing, which uses the energy of the heat of your body to run, and you will have little patches. And these are little biometric little things that attach to your skin. They fall off in 4 days or whatever they're programmed. And these are your communication device. They interact with your physical state, your blood content, your pulse rate. Everything goes into a medical profile all the time. And I think that'll be a big advancement in terms of communication, in terms of monitoring health conditions, in terms of contacting and keeping in contact with a world that is out there beyond that wants to know or has to know how you're doing.
And people will accept this. It sounds rather intrusive.
They're already accepting implants, code chips for their pets, and starting to accept it for children. Now, that is scary. And it sounds almost, you know, fascistic, but the nightmare scenario is that you will be required to have one, otherwise you can't go to the bank, you can't get money, you can't communicate with the media world unless you have one.
Now, does that excite you, or are you a bit spooked by that?
I'm spooked because you should always have the choice to stay home, not go anywhere, and be left alone if that's what you want to do. And if that impacts your whole lifestyle, then that's the lifestyle you've chosen. We call them recluses. Oddly enough, a lot of your science fiction writers, Isaac Asimov, who has left us, unfortunately, a great mind, he refused to fly. He was afraid. And this is the man who wrote about rocket ships, you know, streaking through the universe at beyond light speeds to distant galaxies. He never flew. He was afraid to fly.
Sid Mead, it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Very good. It's an honor to be on NPR.
Come back and talk to us again.
I hope so.
Sid Mead is an illustrator, conceptual designer, and futurist. He also helped create some of our most famous science fiction film worlds, including Blade Runner, Aliens, and Tron.
Our last word in business is a eulogy to the world's first commercial internet browser. Netscape Navigator helped popularize the web, but as surfers switched to Internet Explorer, Netscape's market share dwindled. Its current owner, AOL, tried to keep the browser alive, but AOL's just announced that as of February 1st, 2008, it will no longer release security and other updates for Netscape Navigator, thus ending support. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne. On Mondays, we talk about technology, and this being the last day of the year, we ask Morning Edition's technology guru, Mario Armstrong, to pick his favorite tech innovation of the year. And let me guess, what could it possibly be?
Oh,
if I were to say the word
phone? Look, I wasn't the only one. Time magazine also made this the, you know, they did the inventions of 2007, and the iPhone was number one on the front cover for a reason.
And talk to us about that.
Well, there's, you know, the fact that, number one, it's touch screen. I mean, cell phones back in the day, you never thought about touching the screen. You don't touch the screen. So the iPhone brought that to reality. Visual voicemail. Being able to see voicemail before you actually need to listen to it, that's a huge advancement that we haven't seen in devices before. And then the integration of all the things like your digital camera, your movies, and with iTunes software, Apple really kind of, I think because they were outside of the cell phone industry, they brought a new excitement and new energy into the design of cell phones for the mobile industry.
You have brought in, for our delectation, some old technology.
Yes.
Some cell phones from the past.
That would take us back to about 1983. The actual first time that you could make a call on a device that you could buy was the Motorola Dynatac 8000X is what it was called. Here's what it sounds like. And oddly enough, Dynatac stood for Dynamic Adaptive, and here's the kicker, Renee, Total Area Coverage.
Whoa.
So, yeah, can you imagine back in 1983, total area coverage? We can't get it today. They were doing something better in 1983 than we are today. But this is a large phone. This is a brick phone, and it's very, very heavy, about 3 pounds. And when you put it up beside your face, it's much larger than the size of your head.
So it isn't the sort of thing people would be like waltzing down the street, chit-chatting with friends.
Not at all. And your talk time was only about 30 minutes.
30 minutes.
30 minutes of talk time before your battery died. Oh. Today it's 240 minutes. So we're chatterboxes much more today.
Well, who bought this big lug of a phone?
This phone back then was just under $4,000 in 1983. So initially, it was given to doctors, lawyers, and executives that wanted to have that communication on the go. And as price started to come down, more and more people started finding reasons why they wanted one.
What was the next couple of things they could get?
Okay. So this phone was your bag phone. This was like a small briefcase or a small purse. It weighed about 5 to 6 pounds. It also had a shoulder strap, and the speaker was on this other part of the bag. So you would hold the handset to your head. You would have a cord that would connect to this handle unit that you would carry with you, but you could also put it into your vehicle. Couple that with the price of $200, and we saw adoption starting to take off with mobile technology.
All right, so bag phones went away, though, by the late 90s. What did we have then for a while?
Well, then we got rid of all the baggage, no pun intended. And now we just had a single device, a handheld device that we could carry with us. The device was about maybe 4 inches, and it was only about maybe 2.5 inches thick, lasted much longer in terms of battery life and talk time, and it was easier to conceal. So the Motorola flip phone became that icon for that era.
And put this in perspective. By now, we're talking the late 90s. How many people are using cell phones?
About 55 million were actually carrying cell phones in this time frame.
That's pretty amazing.
That's still amazing, right? I mean, it's only 10 years ago, but if you move towards 2007, where we are today, we're at 250 million.
Which gets us back to the iPhone. Is iPhone going to be the pinnacle for a while?
I don't know if that. I think iPhone has really created the excitement for the industry, and you're seeing so many experiments now taking place. You're also seeing phone companies and telecommunications providers open up their networks. They've never really been conducive to allowing third-party developers, people that develop applications or devices for their network. That's usually been a closed arena. Well, now that they're feeling the pressure of opening that arena, we're going to see so much more advancement, so much more rapidly, that it's really hard to predict. I mean, I know people are working on things like projecting out of cell phones. You could go into a business meeting and not need a laptop and a projector. You just have your cell phone and you run your PowerPoint presentation. And we're also seeing remote control uses for cell phones, health monitoring. There are so many limitless ideas. It's really hard to gauge the crystal ball of what's going to stick and what won't.
What has been driving the technology? Is it consumer demand or one technology just leading to another because people are out there thinking it up?
I think it's a mixture. I think you have both the consumer demand. People do want to connect more often. And I think they're also looking at new developments, things like GPS. That was really never available on cell phones before. So I think these new features, as well as just the consumer appetite of people wanting to stay in touch, it's almost become what you expect to carry. As Americans, we pretty much carry 3 devices with us, Renee. Our wallets, our keys, and of course, our cell phones. I'm sorry, my cell phone is ringing. I apologize for this.
Hey, Mario, it's okay. You go ahead and take that call. And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Goodbye. Hello. Yeah, I'm on the air at NPR.
Mario Armstrong is Morning Edition's regular commentator on technology. He also hosts the technology show Armstrong's Digital Spin on member station WEAA in Baltimore.
We want you to take a moment now to remember all of the personal information you voluntarily gave out this year. Name, address, telephone and credit card numbers, library records, flight information, financial transactions, cameras, recording your movements and your purchases. You are a walking data bank. So, how much privacy do you really have? What information can be considered truly private? If you post your personal life on a website, are you protected if it's used without your knowledge or consent? Provocative questions. We pose now to our guests in the studios of KQED in San Francisco. First, James Rule is the author of Privacy in Peril. He's a scholar at the Center for the Study of Law and Society at UC Berkeley. Welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you.
And welcome as well to Catherine Montgomery. She is the author of Generation Digital, and she's also a professor at American University School of Communication, and she heads the Center's Youth Media and Democracy Project. Welcome to you, Catherine.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
James Rule, let me start with you. Given the laundry list of personal info I just recited, how much of our private lives are actually public?
Much more than we think. You mentioned things that we voluntarily relinquish, information that we voluntarily give up about ourselves, but website visits, supermarket choices. We're constantly generating information about ourselves that we may not realize we're generating. But as in many other cases, we don't ultimately know what fate that information may have.
Catherine Montgomery, I want to bring you into the conversation. On the whole, the young generation is very technology savvy, very comfortable providing private information in a public forum, websites such as Facebook and YouTube, as well as the blogs. You know, we used to write a diary when we were kids, and we kept it hidden and locked, and maybe we moved on to handwritten journals when we were in college. But today, there's a proliferation of webcams. So how do you think this generation and, more important, future generations perceive the whole idea of privacy?
Well, they're not growing up with the same sense of privacy that perhaps I grew up with. And for that reason, I think we need to help them understand what privacy is and to make more conscious decisions about what they share. I think there's also a role, though, for the marketers who are purposefully encouraging young people to provide all this information. I think there's also a role for government agencies to play in creating some guidelines on how people's privacy needs to be protected.
One thing that Catherine said that I utterly concur with is that people's sense of privacy changes enormously from generation to generation, and nowadays I think even from year to year. In many ways, our lives have gotten more private in that we're not obliged to share information with our immediate neighbors or our communities as much as we were perhaps a generation or two ago. On the other hand, we live in this peculiar world where it comes naturally to us to provide to distant bureaucracies like the people who do your health care administration information, extremely personal information, so sensitive that you wouldn't want to even discuss it with your most intimate partners. So the idea of what is private and what reasonably can be kept secret changes, and it changes in tandem with our ability to defend our claims to keep certain kinds of information to ourselves.
I wondered about that. Since privacy tends to be lost in small doses, do we notice what we're giving up?
I don't think we do. And often when we do, we're not served up with choices in a form that make it meaningful to choose a more private world. If everyone is losing his or her personal information when they board an airplane or when they shop at the supermarket, when doing routine things, no single personal act of resistance is going to do much good. I think the only meaningful solutions to the big kind of historic questions about the future of privacy have to come through some kind of collective decision-making and some collective action in the form of legislation, court decisions, or other policy measures.
Catherine Montgomery, is there a line?
I think there is a line, but I think that line needs to be defined more clearly. I believe we're really at a very important historical moment when it is time to have a public debate about privacy, how we can ensure that privacy is protected in the future. I think many of us have become a little bit passive and complacent about it, but there are lines that will need to be drawn, in particular in the digital marketplace, where certain kinds of information maybe should not be collected at all. If you go online and use a search engine to look up symptoms of a disease that you think you might have, that is right now considered fair game for the search engines and for the marketing companies that work with the search engines. And that information is collected. You go to a library, that librarian is not going to follow you around with a marketer on his arm to see what books you're looking up or what you're looking up in an encyclopedia. But in the case of online, all of that right now is fair game.
What information do you think should be protected as private no matter what?
One thought I've often had is that it would be a wonderful thing in America if Americans had a property right over the commercial use of information about themselves, so that the selling and trading of information about oneself could not go ahead unless one formally relinquished one's right over that data. It would be like mineral rights or water rights and real property. But if the legal status of personal information, both for adults and children, were changed so that it were simply illegal to trade in personal data, to buy it, to sell it, to exchange it for value, without the informed permission of the individual, then the power relations between the users of personal data and the ordinary folks like us would immediately shift.
James Rule is the author of Privacy in Peril, published by Oxford University Press, and he's a scholar at the Center for the Study of Law and Society at the University of California, Berkeley. Catherine Montgomery is a professor at American University School of Communication. She's the author of Generation Digital, published by MIT Press, and she's the head of the Center's Youth Media and Democracy Project. They joined us from the studios of member station KQED in San Francisco. Thank you very, very much for this discussion.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure to be here.
We'll be right back.